This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Right now, there's a crisis brewing on Capitol Hill. And I know crisis is a supremely overused phrase in the media, but in this case, I think it's apt because for Democrats on the Hill, there is a crisis. And the crisis is of their own making. President Joe Biden ran on the promise of making once-in-a-generation change in this country, the Democrats' infrastructure and social spending plans topping $4 trillion over 10 years, or, better put, $400 billion per year. Well, usually Democrats enjoy pointing the finger at Republicans, calling them the obstructionist party. But in this case, Democrats are running into a brick wall of other Democrats, needing no help at all from the GOP to potentially scuttle two once-in-a-generation opportunities. So what is happening and what could happen next? That is what we're going to try to understand today on a fast-moving day in Congress. So Jack Beatty, On Point's news analyst, joins us. Hello there, Jack.
Hello, Meghna.
And Lisa Desjardins, who reports on Congress as a correspondent for PBS NewsHour, is with us from Washington as well. Hi, Lisa.
Hi, good to talk to you.
Been able to sleep in the past couple of days, Lisa?
Not so much. Not so much.
What is going on right now? What's the latest on whether or not any one of these bills might actually make it? Let's start with the House, to the floor of the House.
Yeah, it is an incredibly complicated time. I said this last night, but to me, it's about as clear as a glass of mud what is going to happen at this point. With the House right now, we have sort of these four colliding issues when it comes to reconciliation, that large Build Back Better bill that the Biden administration is counting on, and infrastructure. Today is an absolutely critical day where we will see if Nancy Pelosi can somehow get progressives on board a vote on the infrastructure bill, that bill that already passed the Senate, tomorrow. That is what she has pledged to do as of last night. Leadership sources, including members, were telling us that that vote is still on. However, we know that there are dozens of progressives who are vowing to vote no. Pelosi has an incredibly thin margin. She can only lose three Democratic votes and still get it across. Even for Nancy Pelosi, it is hard to see how she squares this circle. You know, as Democrats say, if anyone can do it, she can. But for many of us, it's really hard to see how within one day, progressives can get the kind of guarantee they need on reconciliation, which involves senators to guarantee something that they need in order to vote for infrastructure.
Right.
So it just is hard to see.
Well, so hearing you say that Pelosi can only afford to lose three Democratic votes, I was seeing as of last night, Representative Jayapal of Washington State, one of the leaders of the Progressive Caucus, says she thinks she's got 60 votes against the first infrastructure bill unless there's that major change, as you're saying, coming from the Senate side, specifically from Senators Manchin and Sinema.
That's right. And the problem is that Jayapal's viewpoint is growing. The momentum is growing for progressives, especially when Bernie Sanders, top progressive in the country, said to them, don't vote for the infrastructure bill unless we get more in reconciliation. So their position is firming up. Meanwhile, Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema publicly are not showing any signs of giving not just a guarantee, but even saying how large they want this package to be. So in congressional language, it almost feels like, you know, you've got to get those numbers moving months before you see legislation, much less one day before you see legislation. My reporting is that really Joe Manchin is the one who is taking longer to decide here, that Kyrsten Sinema may be more ready to move and push forward some figures, start getting and negotiating, but that Joe Manchin is taking a little bit longer. And part of this is also on the table, is potentially some money, this is my reporting, to help transition away from coal, because there are real climate change provisions involved here, some of which would potentially negatively affect the coal industry and coal jobs. And so I think Manchin is also negotiating on the future of some jobs in his state.
Okay, Jack Beatty, how do you read this moment where the Democrats themselves are standing in the way of what broadly I'd say the party thinks are potentially transformative changes that they could bring to the country?
Well, it vindicates the epigram of Will Rogers. I'm not a member of an organized political party. He said, "I'm a Democrat," and that would seem to be the case. And you know, for the historically minded, this is a worrying moment. In the last days of the Weimar Republic, the left couldn't get together, and they argued over small matters like increasing they brought down a government over the issue of unemployment compensation. Meanwhile, the wolf got closer and closer to the door. That's the issue in America today, the wolf. The authoritarian Donald Trump is getting closer to the door. He may not run again in 24, but it looks like he will. And meanwhile, the Democrats are arguing about what, compared to putting our democracy on the line, looks like small beans. You know, Freud called it the narcissism of small differences, where you magnify these small things and you miss the big picture. The big picture is American democracy could well be on the line in making Biden a success, because if these bills go down, if the Democrats can't get together, he's a terminally wounded president.
Mm. Well, Jack and Lisa, we've been hearing a lot of frustration from On Point listeners about what is happening literally as we speak on the Hill. For example, here's Valerie from Vermont, who just says she needs Congress to do its job.
I just need them to get it done. Let's stop acting like sixth graders on the school ground. You know, the people of America need this. Yeah, it's going to add to our debt, which is already astronomical. But, you know, we need to get this done now to have a good result in the long term. And then we'd be able to pay back that debt.
So, Lisa, first fact check us here for a second. How much more would these bills, these proposals add to the debt? Valerie has the idea that it would be an astronomical addition.
No, actually, it wouldn't. Yeah. You know, the devil is in the details, of course, in how you interpret all of the numbers. But Democrats have pledged to fully pay for the reconciliation bill itself. The infrastructure deal is separate. So let's just talk about the reconciliation. When you hear that $3.5 trillion figure, that is the size of the programs that would be involved. That's not the bottom line kind of net figure. Net, Democrats say, with the tax increases that they propose, largely on corporations and on American individuals making over $400,000, they would pay for this. They say this does not add red ink. You know, I think if we go farther down the road here, we're going to have to evaluate those numbers more closely. But overall, no, it is not intended, at least, to add to the debt at all. Really, this is more of a debate over philosophy and how large you think government should be and who government should be helping. Democrats really feel, I understand Jack's point that Biden and how you see his presidency is completely on the line here. That's true. But the reason Democrats are really spending time on this bill is because they think this is their only chance at having a substantial program, substantially tackling climate change, for example, substantially tackling childcare, substantially tackling drug prices. This is it. This is their one shot. And that's why they're spending so much time on it.
Well, Jack, we've got comments coming in here. Connie Fish on Twitter says, disappointed the progressives are actually causing regression due to stubbornness. Read up on the process of compromise. And Guy says, members of Congress should listen to voters and not corporate donors. Most of these programs have support even among Republicans. And I would presume that Guy is saying Republican voters, because they don't have support with Republicans on the Hill. But Jack, you know, it seems like this, in a sense, is actually a reflection of America at this moment, too, is it not?
Well, it is. And you can see that if you contrast two districts. Cori Bush is the representative from Missouri's first. She's a member of the Progressive Caucus. Josh Gottheimer is the leader of the Democrats, the nine Democrats who insisted on the first vote for the infrastructure bill. He represents suburban New Jersey, Passaic County, the bosky precincts of Livingston and so on. Two politicians, two districts, two Americas. Bush is Missouri first, 50% African-American. Gottheimer's New Jersey fourth, 4%. Median household income, Missouri one, $50,000. New Jersey, 110,000. Holders of college degrees in Missouri first, 27%. In New Jersey fifth, 44%. 16% below poverty line in St. Louis, 5% in New Jersey. Married, marriage increasingly is an upper middle class good. Married, 36% in the St. Louis district, 57% in New Jersey. Home ownership, on and on, and home prices, and meanwhile, Missouri won, went for Biden by 80%. New Jersey fifth. He only squeaked by a few points, and Trump won the district in 2016. So it's a tough situation for Gothheimer to support higher taxes. His big issue, in fact, is a tax cut for the people, the wealthier real estate holders in his district who want to restore the full state and local income tax deduction that the Trump tax cut limited. Cori Bush's main point to just show the differences is to, for somehow prevent eviction of for tenants. Mm-hmm. She was herself homeless, and she is trying to, that's her main issue. So you couldn't see the one wants tax cuts for wealthy homeowners. The other wants a moratorium on evictions for the most vulnerable.
Right. So another version of two Americas, right? But I mean, I suppose many Americans are wondering, in bills of this magnitude, is there not a way to reconcile the two? And why, if this is like the center of the Democrats' agenda for this year, why can't they find how to reconcile those two? So Jack Beatty and Lisa Desjardins, stand by, because when we come back from the break, we're going to hear from two members of Congress, someone from the Progressive Caucus and someone who sees a different way forward for the Democrats at this moment. So we'll hear from them when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. And today we are talking about the Democrats in Congress and whether or not they can push through their two central ideas for this year, that $1 trillion infrastructure bill and that $3.5 trillion social infrastructure bill. Again, that's spending over 10 years, but it's really the marquee effort of the Biden administration and the Democrats. And yet, as one Hill observer called it, the Democrats are behaving as if they are in a circular firing squad. And could it all not come to pass? I'm joined today by Lisa Desjardins. She's a correspondent for PBS's NewsHour. She's with us from Washington. And Jack Beatty, On Point's news analyst, is with us as well. And Lisa and Jack, we want to hear from members of Congress who are literally at this moment trying to suss this out. So first of all, this is Representative Ayanna Pressley, Democrat of Massachusetts, member of the Progressive Caucus. And if that infrastructure bill, that $1 trillion infrastructure spending bill over 10 years, if it comes to the House for a vote tomorrow, how will she vote on it?
I would vote no. If it comes down to it, I would vote no on the roads and bridges bill in order to hold the line and to get the other bill done. We need both. Meghna, I'm not going to choose between the life and livelihood of the union worker building our roads and the child care worker keeping our babies safe. That's a false choice. And the Democrats are in power, and we don't have to give in to these false choices. This is the president's agenda. This is the people's agenda. And progressives are fighting hard to get this done for the people.
Well, right now, it most certainly seems as if two Democrats, in fact, on the Senate side, as you well know, Senators Manchin and Sinema, are the linchpins here. They haven't been willing to put forth a number in terms of what they would support in the social spending bill, but there may be, over the course of today or tomorrow, I'm hearing, a framework that might emerge. Would that be enough for you?
Megan, we have a history in this country of whenever there is a scenario that says, let's take what we can get and we'll get to the rest later, the people that get left behind are the most marginalized. The pandemic has laid bare every inequity, disparity, and racial injustice, and they have all been exacerbated. We say we're in the midst of a national reckoning on racial injustice. That means that we can leave no one behind. We can't have a recovery to a pre-COVID status quo unjust normal. The Massachusetts 7th Congressional District, which I represent, one of the most unequal districts in the country. Childcare, second highest cost of childcare in the country. Childcare infrastructure is not a nice to have, it is a must have. That's about the stabilization of our families and our workforce. I have a huge public housing footprint in my district, housing that is dilapidated and falling down around people. It's subpar housing. It's a threat to people's public health because of long overdue maintenance and investments and upgrades that have not happened. And finally, I represent a district that is 53% people of color, 40% foreign born, many of them TPS holders, DACA recipients, many of them the same essential workers that people were offering verbal bouquets to, but now don't want to prioritize a pathway to citizenship for them. Mm. So physical infrastructure must happen. Human infrastructure must happen. I reject these false binary choices versus a union worker building our roads and bridges and a child care worker keeping our babies safe and setting them on a successful life trajectory. We need both, and they should move in tandem. And Manchin and Sinema, I'd have to be surprised to be disappointed. They have been consistently obstructing. I think they have contempt for the American people. And I continue to call on the president to exert the full weight of his presidency, both to abolish this filibuster and to lean on Manchin and Sinema to do right by the American people. The fact that they've been focused on the number and not the substance already indicates the challenge here. The American people, they don't care about antiquated Washington process or DC procedures. They're just focused on surviving every day.
Representative, I heard you say that you think Senators Manchin and Sinema have contempt for the American people. Is that right?
Yes, that is how I feel, because they have not heard the cries of the American people in any number of issues. The point is, they have been obstructionist and unwilling to do what we're supposed to do, and that is to stand in the gap and to get relief to the American people in the midst of a global pandemic, experiencing a pandemic-induced recession, which is a wrought unprecedented economic hardship. I'm not interested in the political gamesmanship and toying with people's lives and livelihoods. We have to stand in the gap. We have the majority, and that has to be more than a talking point. It has to mean something. This is about delivering to the American people.
Well, Representative, let me ask you, though, when you say the bills must move in tandem, it seems likely or perhaps they may not. And I do wonder, for all those people that you talked about who need the kind of assistance that the bills could provide, is the perfect the enemy of the good here? Because I get you what you're saying about false binary choices, but there's the political reality of what's going on the Hill right now. It does seem entirely possible that Democrats could come out the other end of this process, perhaps with nothing. And then what would the consequences be of that?
I'm not operating, and I don't determine my votes based on hypotheticals. The deal was always that these two bills move together, and we won't agree to anything that doesn't guarantee passage of the Build Back Better Act. We've been saying this all along. So we're not moving the goalposts here. And I reject the scenario there that was offered, because there's no reason why that should be happening. We have the House, we have the Senate, and we have the White House.
As a party, but in the party struggles that are happening internally are stopping the progress on both of these bills. Now, last question to you, Representative Presley. In a little bit, we're going to be speaking with Congressman Henry Cuellar of Texas, Democrat of Texas, who sees things a little bit differently from the majority of the Progressive Caucus. So what would you tell him? How would you try to convince him that the path that the Progressive Caucus wants to take on these two bills is the right path?
Like, now I understand that there are, you know, some of the opinion that by moving boldly to meet the urgent needs and to meet the moment, that we run the risk of compromising the majority. But I would submit to them that we stand to risk the majority by playing small, not by going big. The ultimate persuasion tool is impact. We need to be focused on substance and impact and centering everyone who calls this country home. And our relief and our investments must go as bold, as broad, and as deep as the hurt and uncertainty is that they are experiencing right now. This is an unprecedented moment, and the question is whether or not we will meet it.
Representative Ayanna Pressley, Democrat of Massachusetts, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, let's turn now to Congressman Henry Cuellar, who is representing Texas's 28th congressional district, and he joins us from Washington. Congressman Cuellar, welcome back to On Point, and let me just get you to respond to what you heard Representative Pressley say there at the end, that if Democrats don't go big and bold, they risk losing the majority here.
Yeah, and I agree. You know, we have a lot of points in agreement with each other. You know, we certainly want to improve education. We certainly want to improve health care. We certainly want to make sure that we remake the safety net. I think this is what the reconciliation is all about, remaking the safety net. I think we're in agreement, but we got to understand we are in a legislative process. A legislative process, just basically for the history of our country, means that there's give and take. Sometimes there's a give and take between Democrats and Republicans, and sometimes there's give and take within a particular political party. This time it's the Democrats. Back after the 2010, after we lost, when we went big, in 2010, we lost the majority by going big. And the Republicans then had their Tea Party people, and they had their own differences. So the bottom line is we have a lot of things in common. Mm. And I agree with my colleagues.
Well, you mentioned 20.
And that's where we're at.
Yeah, well, you mentioned 2010 there, I presume referencing the passage of the Affordable Care Act. We're going to talk about that later in the show. But Representative Cuellar, the thing that's confusing me, though, is where is the give and take happening right now between Democrats? Because you heard Representative Pressley expressing her frustration that on the Senate side, at least, they're not even getting a number. You're not even getting a number, say, from Joe Manchin. So is there adequate give and take actually happening right now?
Well, you know, I don't speak for Senator Manchin. I certainly don't speak for Senator Kyrsten Sinema. I do talk to them very frequently. Just talked to them just a couple days ago. So I talk to them frequently. I do have a number that I think Senator Joe Manchin is willing to go to, but that is his job to talk about that.
Can you give us a hint about the number? I mean, if you say you have it.
No, you have to get him on your show to ask him that
We keep
question.
Asking. But has that number come from you or from him?
He has told me what he can live with. And again, it's not my job to talk about that. He and his mind knows what the way, you know, I can tell you this is the way he looks at it. And not the number, but let me just tell you the way I think the thought process. Some people, and I was not in the room when they said, hey, it's going to be $3.5 trillion. Hey, we got a couple of the transportation and the reconciliation. I was not in that room, and I don't think Senator Joe Manchin was in that room. So what people are doing, some people are looking at, here's $3.5. Let's fill it up with items, and then let's look how we pay for it. He looks at it different. He says, okay, what are the needs that we have? Here's the need. here's a need, and then let's see what we end up with that number. See, it's a different approach. I'm just saying the way the senator, I think, is looking at it. I'm not speaking for him, but this is my understanding, my perceptive of our conversations.
Okay. Well, so back in August, though, you co-authored an op-ed where you told the progress, or you said that the Progressive Caucus is, is essentially holding the infrastructure bill hostage, right? When they were pushing for them to be passed in tandem. It looks like House Speaker Nancy Pelosi is not going to do that anymore. But what could you do, or what do you promise to do, though, to help get that second bill, that social spending bill, done through reconciliation?
Yes, and certainly they were trying to couple this. I mean, somebody, like I said, I was not in the room when somebody came up with a decision to couple this together. I mean, look, we know the legislative process. Before this reconciliation came up, the president was spending all this time with senators to come up with this bipartisan bill. So everybody was, yes, yes, let's do this bipartisan bill. By the way, historic. It's a historic bill, number one. And then somewhere down the line in a room, which I was not part of, somebody came up, you're going to couple them together, you're going to hold that hostage, and you're going to we're going to be voting on 3.5. I mean, I apologize. I was not in that room. So, yes, it was being held hostage. Now, it's been decoupled. We're going to vote on this. We're going to pass the bipartisan infrastructure bill, which will be historic. 2 million jobs a year for the next 10 years, and monies for our roads and bridges, broadband, water, et cetera. Now, I also support a reconciliation bill. Mm. I do. I really do. I'm a big believer in education. I'm a big believer in health care. Are there some differences? Of course they are. For example, some people want to do Medicaid Plus and not do Medicaid gap expansion. I think we can do both. So there's, you know, that's the give and take that I'm talking about. And I commit myself. I emphasize, I commit myself to pass and people call it a reconciliation. That's only a process. I call it remaking the safety net for the most vulnerable people that we have. And I will do that. But again, it's got to be a product that all 50 senators in the Senate can pass, along with a majority of Democrats in the House.
Well, Representative Henry Cuellar, Democrat of Texas, with us from Washington today. Representative, thank you so very much.
Thank you so much.
Okay, Lisa Desjardins, let me turn back to you here. Were you surprised to hear Representative Cuellar say that Joe Manchin might have told him a number he could live with for the reconciliation bill?
Yeah, I definitely perked up when I heard that because, you know, I'm not sure he's told a lot of people what that number is. And in fact, Manchin told us reporters yesterday that he did not give the president that number when he met with the president at the White House yesterday. He was a little bit evasive on that question, but in the end, he said it was just negotiating. He may have given him a range, but yes, I think Representative Cuellar is someone I'm going to make a beeline to at the Capitol today. But, you know, I think those interviews were so strong and you could really hear the divide there. Representative Presley is obviously on one end of the Democratic Party. She was saying some very sharp thing about other Democrats. But you could hear what's going on here is that these Democrats represent different groups of people. Joe Manchin is thinking about West Virginia. I just spent the weekend in his hometown in West Virginia to try and understand how he thinks. And he is grounded in what his voters need and want. And they are very worried about coal. They are very worried about the size of government. And also, as a note, Manchin likes to work with opposing forces all in one room at one time. That's not happening here. Mm. He is speaking individually. And so I think that's why the process may be taking a little bit longer for him right now.
All right. Well, Lisa, I'm going to let you go so you can go find Cuellar and tell the rest of America what he was talking about. So Lisa Desjardins, correspondent for PBS's NewsHour, speaking to us from Washington. Thank you, Lisa.
My pleasure.
Okay, Jack, we've got about a minute to go before the break here. So your takeaway from what you heard both Presley and Cuellar say.
Well, with Presley, I mean, her statement about Manchin and Sinema, she said, "I'd be surprised to be disappointed in them." What a comment. And that they have, quote, contempt for the American people. But, of course, as Lisa reminds us, Manchin, West Virginia went to, by for Trump by almost 40 points. And Sinema just hung on in her last election in a state that Biden won by, what, 11,000. Meanwhile, Presley is in a super safe district. So it's, you know, relatively easy for her to take a maximalist position without understanding that Sinema and Manchin are in a different place electorally.
Well, Jack, hang on here for just a second, because we've already heard a couple of times during the course of this hour that maybe there are some lessons learned or to be learned from the 2010 passage of the Affordable Care Act and what it took to take Democrats to push that over the line. So we're going to talk about that when we come back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and things are in flux on Capitol Hill regarding the fate of two of the most important bills that Democrats have put forward, important for their party, and they say a unique moment for the country. There's that $1 trillion infrastructure bill and the $3.5 trillion reconciliation bill. Again, those two numbers spending over 10 years. But the problem here right now is that there's deep disagreement amongst Democrats themselves on how to get those bills to completion. And so that's what we're talking about today, trying to figure out what's happening at the moment on the Hill and what could come next. So what we want to do for a moment is take a step back here and talk about the last time that a major historic bill was pushed through with no Republican votes whatsoever, similar to what we're seeing now, but also having to overcome Democratic infighting. And that, of course, we're talking about the 2010 passage of the Affordable Care Act. So we reached out to two former members of Congress, I should say, who cast their votes for the ACA and then subsequently lost their seats in the midterm elections following that vote. And we wanted to know what lessons they thought that experience had for current members of Congress. So this is former Congressman Tom Perriello. He used to represent Virginia's 5th District, and he is a Democrat who lost his seat after the ACA vote. He had only served one and his first and only term.
It was an honor to do it. I was a deciding vote, and I feel like the bar for political courage has been set a little too low. That, you know, being a Democrat voting to expand healthcare reform shouldn't be such a monumental achievement. But the fact that I tend to get dragged out on these occasions shows that it can be rare, and it does. It is something people remember for a very long time.
Same goes for former Representative Earl Pomeroy, who served as congressman for North Dakota's at-large congressional district.
Now, we had some polling data before the vote. It showed about 60-40. I probably wouldn't be reelected if I voted for the bill.
Well, he did. He voted for the ACA.
Here's the deal. There are more important things than whether one wins a re-election. This had been the most important opportunity to improve access to health care since they passed Medicare.
Well, and as we said, Pomeroy lost his seat. About 45% of North Dakotans voted for Pomeroy compared to 55% for Republican Rick Berg. But Pomeroy says he doesn't yet know how he would vote for the current infrastructure and social spending bills. However, he told us he implores his fellow Democrats to understand what's at stake.
Well, in the course of a congressional career, there comes rarely, but once in a while, comes a vote that's frankly more important than whether one returns to the next Congress or not, whether one can win the next election or not. This is a very big bill. It'll be up to the individual member to decide whether or not their politics individually are more important than President Biden being able to move his promises forward to the American people.
And Tom Perriello says that $3.5 trillion reconciliation bill would be an easy vote for him to cast.
If you look at the changes being proposed, this is why it's so strange from the centrists. They're proposing things that make the bill less popular. The cuts they're talking about are going to cut out the middle class. You water down the investments in green jobs that can help redevelop communities. If you get rid of the prescription drug reform piece, not only are you increasing the deficit, but you're also increasing the costs of middle class families to get prescription drugs for themselves or their aging parents. So the fact is, this bill passing right now is a great thing for frontline Democrats. Plus, they'll then have over a year to go out and get very specific with voters about the benefits that have been delivered from the bill. There's not a single example in modern history of a bill getting more popular by taking longer to pass it. Nor is it true in this day and age that watering down the bill makes it better. And the cost of that failing will only look like Democrats don't know how to be in charge and aren't trying to deliver for the working and middle class.
That's former Congressman Tom Perriello. Well, I'm joined today again by Jack Beatty, On Point News analyst. And joining us now is Molly Ball, national political correspondent for Time and author of the book Pelosi. Molly, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you so much, Magnus. Great to be here.
So really want to hear from you about what lessons you think are to be learned from the 2010 passage of the ACA, because I went back and read sections of your book about Nancy Pelosi, and the wheeling and dealing, the hardball, the way she shepherded her caucus through seems remarkable. Are you seeing the same Nancy Pelosi at work today?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, Nancy Pelosi's superpower has always been holding her caucus together. She has, you know, political scientists have studied it. She has achieved more unity among Democrats, among her own party, than any Speaker of the House in American history. That being said, she's operating with very little margin for error, right? If you go back to 2010, the Democrats had, I think, you know, a 75-plus seat majority, so she had a lot more votes that she could lose. She can lose virtually no one at this point. So this is coming, you know, at sort of what most people assume is near the end of her legislative career, a chance to go out on a real high note if she can pull it off. But it does require her to marshal really all of those skills that she has spent decades honing, and there's no trick to it. I think a lot of people think that there's some, you know, there's some procedural trick or there's some silver bullet, some magic thing that she could pull out of her bag. But it's really just that she knows all these members extremely well. She understands them extremely well. And she has a very fine-tuned sense of human nature. So the members of the Democratic caucus talk about these negotiating sessions with Nancy Pelosi as sometimes they're called therapy sessions or prayer sessions. She just listens to everybody, has everybody explain themselves, and then she pushes them as far as she can. And when she feels like she's gotten them as far as she can, she goes and does, you know, the shuttle diplomacy uh-huh. with the next group that she's speaking to. And it's just pushing and pushing and pushing until she gets to the point where everybody has found something that they can support, and they clearly are not there yet.
Well, so what worked in 2010, though? Will it work today? Because Molly, again, your book is so good, because I was going back and I was reading the section about how Nancy Pelosi had to convince some really critical fellow female Democrats back in 2010 that their priorities around protecting abortion, they just had to put that aside, right, to get the ACA passed. Very hard line that Nancy Pelosi had to take, and she had to convince them to do that. And then also later on, there's a point that you write in the book where Pelosi felt strong enough about her control over her caucus to say that basically the House wouldn't compromise on a lot of things. But she does not have, as you said, that kind of margin now. I mean, do you think that she has the tools, the craftiness to deal with this muscular progressive caucus that we've been talking about?
Well, I don't know, and I don't make predictions, but I would say that right now, I mean, what you just heard on the show and what we have heard and what I've heard in my reporting is that there is really a feeling that right now the ball is in the Senate's court and in the president's court. And that is part of Pelosi's strategy as well, mm-hmm. right, to put pressure on those other branches. And there is a feeling that they have to come to the table because the House has come to the table. Pelosi is at the table, right? She's doing this work, but they can't just do it on the House side, because one of the demands, and it's a fair demand by progressives, is some kind of assurance from the Senate that they will proceed in some way on something resembling the reconciliation bill. But look, the way I see Pelosi acting now, she's acting very confident. She clearly believes that she will get out of this alive and that the whole thing will not fall apart. But that doesn't mean she knows how she's going to get there. I think it could be ugly. It's always John McCain used to say it's always darkest before it's totally black. But I think the Democrats all know that everything is on the line for them here, right? I mean, and everybody wants to get to yes. That said, they are staking out, you know, very firm positions because they want to get as much as possible. But that scene you described from 2009, when Nancy Pelosi was trying to get the original House version of the health care bill through, and she did have to go to, you know, she'd spent a lot of time trying to get the Catholic bishops to support an anti-abortion measure that didn't go far enough for them. And when that failed, she did have to go to the pro-choice women. She's always had a lot of credibility with the progressive members. She considers herself a progressive. She has been depicted in literally hundreds of millions of Republican attack ads as this, you know, wild-eyed San Francisco liberal. So she's always had the ability to go to the progressives in the caucus and say, hey, I'm one of you. You have to believe me when I say this is the best that we can do, and I care about your priorities. At the same time, she has to get the moderates to come and meet those progressives halfway. So it is just a game of inches at this point.
Yeah. Well, Jack, let me bring you back in here because Molly said so many important things. And the one that really sticks with me is Nancy Pelosi looking to Joe Biden. Now, Biden's having this flurry of meetings. He had canceled his trip to Chicago, et cetera. But is he doing everything that he can using the full bully pulpit of the presidency? Because I'm thinking, again, back from 2010, Barack Obama gave that speech to the joint session of Congress talking about the importance of passing health care. And I think he even read a letter from the then newly late Senator Ted Kennedy. I mean, are we seeing that kind of presidential push from Biden?
Well, it doesn't seem so. It seems it's behind the scenes now, and he's working what Politico calls the manchinima puzzle, how to get those two senators on board. You know, Richard Neustadt, in his classic book, Presidential Power, wrote, presidential power is the power to persuade. And that the essence of this is essentially to make the person you're dealing with from the other branches realize that what you want is also what he or she should want. But it all depends, Neustadt thought, on the public prestige of the president. Is it high or is it low when he's trying to get what he wants from, say, a member of Congress? Right now, it's not good for Joe Biden. He began with 60% among independents. He's down now to 37%. He's in a weakened position to persuade. And then there are his waning powers of persuasion. Ross Douthat points to, you know, he said it shouldn't be surprising that he's not successful when he has to master strategy or minute detail. And that isn't surprising since, as he puts it rather bluntly, he's an old man suffering, quote, from some manifest deficits relative to his vice presidential self. So it may be that he's not as lively and as vigorous a persuader as he needs to be. Certainly there hasn't been as much public persuasion. And I think the contrast with Obama is a good one. Obama made the joint session just about this Biden's State of the Union dealt largely with it, but it wasn't simply focused on this overwhelmingly.
Yeah. Jack and Molly, lots of comments coming in here. Daniel says, I think it's somewhat misleading to call this a Democratic roadblock. In prior decades, you could lose a few votes in your own party and still build a coalition with some of the other from some of the other party and be okay. Problem here now is that you can't do anything without a solid party line supermajority. And Daniel puts the blame for that on Republicans. And Disco Cola says, my problem isn't with infighting. My problem is that the stakes are low for anyone on the Hill. The worst thing that can happen to most of them is that they don't get reelected. The stakes of this failing are way higher, and I don't trust all of them to have perspective. So, Molly and Jack, there's one last piece of tape I want to play for you, speaking about perspective, because not only do we have what could be, some of the biggest and most ambitious bills on the line here, there's also the midterms as well. And we heard a minute ago from former Congressman Tom Perriello, and he said, really, the biggest perspective is what's good for the American people and how they're going to interpret whatever happens on the Hill this week. And that's why he thinks Democrats should press hard.
Ultimately, in a midterm election, people are voting on the direction of the country and the direction of the president. And the only way they have to do that is how they vote yes or no on their particular member of Congress. So the fact of the matter is, many of the Democrats that voted against the health care bill actually also lost their seats and lost by far worse of a margin. So I think right now, if Democrats pass this legislation and Biden's numbers are up overall, that is going to matter far more for these members than a no vote. In fact, when, you know, had I voted against healthcare, people who didn't like Obama's direction still didn't want the Democrats to control the House. And that's really what they're voting on.
So Molly, how do you respond to that? What do you think?
Well, you know, I want to go back to the comment you read about infighting, because it is odd to me that people see this as some kind of pathology. This is a negotiation. This is what they do in Washington. This is how it's supposed to work. And sure, it's messy. It's ugly. There's a lot of name calling in the middle of it. But we have a big, diverse country, and it's represented by only 435 people who have to come together from all those different points on the map and try and find things that they agree on. The idea that that would be easy, the idea that all those people would share the same perspective, even within the same party, to me, I don't want to, you know, yell at your listeners, and I'm sure that the comment was made with good intentions. I just think, you know, this is a negotiation. This is how this process works. It's not a crisis yet. It will be a crisis for the Democrats if it all falls apart. But, you know, you have the memory of the Affordable Care Act. I think former Congressman Perriello is absolutely right. What the Democrats took away from that was the party sinks and falls together. Whether you as an individual member vote for or against a piece of legislation is far less important to your prospects than whether your party is seen as having been successful overall. And so that is what Democrats are thinking about. They're trying to get to yes on something that they all can agree on the substance. But I think that there's far less calculation on the individual level that they could, you know, one of Nancy Pelosi's mantras that she always says to her caucus, to the point that people roll their eyes, but it's an important one. She says, our diversity is our strength, but our unity is our power. And that is always her message to her members, which is we all have these different perspectives, but we only get anything done at the end of the day if we all row together.
Well, and the question that the American people now have is, can the Democrats find that unity? But Molly Ball, national political correspondent for Time and author of Pelosi, thank you so much for joining us, Molly.
Thank you so much, Magna.
And Jack Beattie, On Point News analyst, always so great to have you, Jack. Thank you.
Thank you, Magna.
I'm Magna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.